Oh, this is the third and final week of our lesson on resilience. We began this lesson hearing from Paul, who told us that there is a source of deep resilience within each of us, a source that when we tap into it, it capacitates us to live lives of calm, lives of composure, irrespective of circumstance. In other words, when things are going well, peace and equanimity is possible. And when things are not going well, peace and equanimity are possible. So early in the lesson, we heard from James, who told us that one of the primary ways that we get to that place, that we tap into that source, that we move beyond our false self-constructs to be able to draw from this life of the divine within us, is the experience of troubles, the experience of pain. The experience itself has within it the capacity to make us stronger. But it also does something that reveals what is often unseen or unknown. What struggles do, what troubles do, is unearth the false self strategies around which we build our lives that are always going to let us down. And having been unearthed makes it available to us to chart a path that backs up from one way of being and going another way. Well, if you're new to our community, I would encourage you to have a listen online to last week because we recapped an important theme for our community's life together. For many years, we have worked on the question, can we still be Christians? Now, the answer was not as immediately obvious as you would think for us being a church because, like many, we had seen how toxic the Christian church had become. Many of us had been on the receiving end of the more harm than good dynamic that is so much a part of church life. And like many, we were tempted to chuck the whole thing, join the ranks of the spiritual but not religious. Except I had personally, and many of us who were part of the community during those years had experiences within the religious tradition. Experiences that had been deeply transformative, meaning-making experiences, life direction kinds of experiences. Of course, we had seen some of the church's worst days, but we'd also been present for many of the church's best days. So we took a harder path. We'd not reject the tradition, but we have been trying to unearth the good from under the encrusting layers that accumulate over time. Well, I said last week, if we want to be resilient people and walk with peace and calm in the easy times and the troubled times, we have to revisit one of the core parts of our Christian story, and that is how we talk about sin. We can't keep framing sin as many Christian churches have for so long. Bad deeds that we have done with punishment attached. It's more helpful, we said, we have found it more helpful to think of sin as an interlocking set of beliefs and motivations and processes, an interior construct that we don't see, and because we don't see it, we can't step out of it, the result of which are bad behaviors or is bad behaviors. But that's the result that we said last week. That's the tip of the iceberg, and you don't run afoul of an iceberg with the tip. You run afoul with what is emerged underneath the surface. That's what will sink the ship. And so if we can't see this interlocking set of beliefs and constructs, then we're never going to step outside of them, and if we don't, we will never be resilient. Because this false version of self, we said, we have found, that's a more helpful way to think about sin. And it helps us see both what these beliefs and strategies are, how we got them, what they are doing to us, how deeply we depend upon them, and that whole interconnected mess, we said, that is worthy of the word sin. And seeing first allows us to start a journey that helps us be free of the power of these constructs. Well, anyway, if you missed last week, I would encourage you to have a listen online. It's kind of a foundational idea for our community. Today, I want to reemphasize a point that I made early in this lesson. And again, here's how James said it. When challenges come into your life, and tests, and troubles, it will help us to see these tough times as precious gifts. Under the pressure of pain and struggle, our true colors surface. We see what we hadn't seen, our weaknesses, our frailties, our blind spots. That's the gift part. Awareness forces us to dig deeply to access an even deeper part of ourselves. So that's the gift part. Awareness forces us to dig deeply to access an even deeper part of ourselves, the indwelling Spirit of God. In this way, struggle awakens us to the deeper life, mature, develop, awakens us. So what James is telling us is that troubles will evoke negative emotional reactions. What we said last week is that it's not actually the troubles themselves that evoke these reactions. Rather, it is the internal belief system that we're carrying around inside of our heads. That's what drives the negative reactions. We have some belief about the way life works or the way it should work. Deeply held, viscerally held belief system. Some belief about ourselves, about what makes us good people, about what makes us valuable people. Some belief about how valuable we are or how valuable we are not. And then we have a cluster of strategies either to help us work with that belief system or to help us distract ourselves from the horrible implications of our belief system. And we carry all that stuff around in our heads. And it dictates our actions, and it dictates our reactions. It dictates who we love and how we love them, what we do and how we do it. But these visceral, internally, deeply held beliefs are ill-informed. These homemade strategies, they never work in the long run. They will always fail us. They will always undercut resilience. And painful times, when they come along, will poke at those strategies. Troubles, when they come, will agitate us. And when that happens, it is a moment of high potential, a moment that invites us to see what typically we don't see, a moment that invites us to unearth what typically lays dormant down in there, running our lives sight unseen. That's what the spiritual journey invites us to do. The spiritual journey invites us to be seers, to see what is so often hidden. To know ourselves is to know the false self, but then to know the divine center that is deeper yet. And these ill-informed beliefs that we carry around, these homemade constructs that we carry around, they are usually invisible to us because they form when we're little boys and little girls. We pick them up quite early. We picked up beliefs about what is good and what is not good. We picked up beliefs about how to become good and who didn't, who is bad. We picked up beliefs about how to control the world or how to be loved. But young as we were, our strategies are not that informed. They weren't fully formed because we weren't that aware back when we picked up these strategies. We certainly, at that point in our life, had not accessed the ancient wisdom. We hadn't even accessed adult maturity. We just grabbed some beliefs to help us navigate our way through our days. So, of course, the false self beliefs are inadequate. Of course, these false self strategies will never work. If they weren't so common, and if they hadn't been reinforced by so many people around us who had also taken up these same belief systems, we would look at them with incredulity. How could we ever have believed that that would make the world work for me? Really? I thought I could make myself safe by getting everybody in the world to like me? I was running my life on the basis of that belief system? Really? Really? I thought I could meet my love needs by being so strong that I was invulnerable, and I thought that would give me intimacy? Really? Really? I thought that that promotion or that bucket of cash would make me feel safe or make me feel valuable. And I lived that way, and I ran my family that way, and I ran off people, and I limited possibilities that way. What was I thinking? If these things weren't so strongly reinforced by everyone around us, we would look at them and say, how could I ever have believed that? Well, if we do come to see how we have been running our lives, we do, by nature, do it later in the game. We do because we've walked the spiritual journey long enough now that we can look back, which means we look back often with regret, which makes that kind of awareness very emotionally demanding to open ourselves to. Because sometimes when we see, it will hurt us to see what we have done and why we have done it. Consequently, it's a place we don't always allow ourselves to go. It's a place of seeing we don't always open ourselves to see. Consequently, the spiritual journey has long issued the invitation to be a journey of awareness. The spiritual journey has long been a journey of seeing what we might not have seen and what we kind of didn't want to see. Seeing what most people buy into that is not true, seeing what we have bought into that is not true. Seeing clearly enough and seeing deeply enough to be able to step back from a long-traveled path and walk another path. And it turns out, the ancients tell us, that pain is one of the common ways that this invitation is issued. Because pain is one of the most common ways that we see. We spent a considerable amount of time talking about that last week. Again, what James tells us is that pain is a gift. Now, in the past, our community, I, by standing up here, have had plenty of pithy ways in which we have spoken about what James said. Here's one. Afflictive emotions are your friend. You might have heard that one come around. Or, pain is not bad, pain is just painful. Or, the point of pain is not to get out of pain. The point of pain is to get out of pain what we need to get out of pain. Pain is an integral part of this journey of awareness. Pain is a common way that people see what we hadn't seen. So, if we make pain the enemy, instead of befriending pain, instead of allowing pain to do what pain does, if we make pain the enemy, we missed one of the greatest gifts that life has to offer us, the gift of sight, the gift of transcending our untrue truths, which translates, we saw last week, into the gift of resilience. Now again, nobody likes pain. If we do like pain, that's a different sermon we'll have to talk about. We don't like pain, but there is also not an imperative, there is not a need for us to devolve into fear and panic when pain shows up in our lives. We needn't have an adversarial relationship with pain. In fact, once we get a glimpse of the bigger picture, once we see the gift that suffering can afford us, once we experience a few rounds of this dynamic where pain leads us to sight, and sight leads us to better truths, and building our lives on better truths awakens us to possibilities we hadn't seen, once we go through the arduous process of unhabituating to the life that we'd lived in the previous things that we had not seen, a few rounds of that, what we called last week salvation, and we begin to change our perspective on pain. It doesn't become as difficult as it had been to befriend our pain. It doesn't become as difficult to staunch the panic when pain shows up. After a few cycles of what we called salvation, it's easier to let pain trigger a quiet place of wondering. I wonder what's in this for me? I wonder what faulty construct is driving my afflictive emotion. Well, that's the ancient wisdom presented to us, inviting us to growth. But you and I live in a society that makes that gift, that wisdom, difficult to access. We are immersed in a cultural worldview with norms and beliefs that are to us what water is to a fish. We swim in these beliefs, we swim in these norms completely unaware of their presence or influence in our lives until we stand back and name it. A derogatory description of one part of these norms that has bearing on today, these norms that confound us being able to access this ancient wisdom, we could call it derogatorily comfort addiction. Comfort addiction. Let me talk a little bit about that to kind of make a case that that would be a suitable term. So we live in a technologically advanced society. There is a tremendous amount of capacity for developing technologies that give us a rising tide of comfortableness. But not only is there a rising tide of comfortableness, there is a rising rate at which the tide of comfortableness is rising. In other words, we are getting more comfort faster at a quicker pace than we used to get it in the past. And so, as these many comfort features become integrated into our lives, we tend to let them fade into the background and they become part of our normalized days. And once we have normalized them, they stop being a brand new, wonderful, thrilling, comfortable thing, and they go through a shift from being new and available to being something that we need. We begin to depend on them. We begin to count on them, and we begin to expect them. Now, you might imagine that this lesson is going to go toward some kind of a Luddite railing upon comfort. It's not, because comfort is good. I am really glad we've got comfort. But I am going to point out that when we come to a dependence on these comforts, there's a downside. There's a big downside. So imagine the experience of those who grew up in a time accustomed to losing their most precious loved ones to sanitation diseases. Imagine how they felt when sinks came into their kitchens and into their bathrooms, when hot and cold water was introduced into their houses, when sewers carried away the wastewater and the sewage. Imagine how they thought, our health, our children's health. Once the possibility of sanitation was integrated into their lives, clean water and waste management right into their houses. Wow, what a wonderful thing this is. What a gift. Well, having experienced that gift, the most natural thing in the world would be to want to do it again, to find another way to make life better. Comfort's not a problem. Comfort is a gift. But as we've seen many times in many ways around this whole arena of the spiritual life, a little bit is a gift, and a little bit more is a gift, and yet a little bit more is a gift, and some more gift and gift and gift. It keeps going on until there is this invisible line, and nobody ever sees it when it gets there, when we're doing the same thing, and all of a sudden gift crosses a line and becomes curse. Some invisible line that tells us too much of that thing that was gift has now made it curse. If you've studied the Enneagram together with Robin and in our community, you have seen this dynamic play out in personalities, and that is in our lives, our curses are almost always the same thing as our gift, just the flip side of it. In other words, we do this thing and it's a gift. We do it this thing, it's a gift. And that at some point, either too much of it or too often or in the wrong context, that same attribute becomes our curse. So, gift, 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 invisible line, curse. How does that happen? When does it happen? A sink, warm water, sanitation, sewer disposal. How about a furnace to warm us in the winter, or light in our homes, or an icebox to keep our food from spoiling? Most would say those are gifts. And most would say, let's do it again. Let's recreate that process of improvement in our culture, in our society. And along the way, somebody decides, you know what, houses need closets. Houses didn't always have closets. Homes didn't always come with them. Their gift was, here's some efficient storage. But closets have profoundly shaped our society. By creating more space in our homes for clothing, they created a new cultural norm, which means now we own more clothing, which means that we bought more clothing, which has led to a different set of social expectations. We don't wear the same clothes too often, or we don't wear them for too long. We get rid of them before they go out of fashion. When they're still wearable but not fashionable, we get rid of them. So, were closets a gift? Well, efficient storage is a gift. Were closets a curse? Well, there is this sense that we get on a treadmill, and it's hard to say. But either way, the comfort gift creates social norms. When we create new comforts, we create new norms. Washing machines and dryers have definitely added comfort to our lives, as have dishwashers and microwaves, and water heaters, and frost-free freezers, and answering machines. What these things do for us is make it increasingly possible for us to avoid the mundane. We do not have to spend the same amount of time that previous generations did doing mundane chores. These machines have made that more difficult. One would say, could say that's a gift. One could say that the treadmill it creates is a curse. Central air and ceiling fans and dual zones of air conditioning for the upstairs and the downstairs. Heated seats in our cars. Separate temperature zones for each person in the car. They make it increasingly possible for us never to feel too hot, never to feel too cold. Radios and stereos and televisions and DVDs and DVRs and smartphones and tablets with books in them and news and music and movies, these make it increasingly possible for us to vanquish boredom. Increasingly possible never to be bored, increasingly possible never to be unentertained. Now, it's not immediately obvious if these things are gifts or curse, but there is an accumulated effect of having all of them in this rising tide and this rising rate of a rising tide, because what it does when the accumulated effect of all of them work together is it changes our brains. It changes who we are and how we think. Things that were once comforts tend to become necessities. Once our brains acclimate to the presence of some comfort, our brains will then render the presence of that comfort essential. And when that happens, we create new norms in our brains and in our society. And the new norm is more comfortable than the old norm was. It becomes normative to be comfortable, and it becomes normative not to be uncomfortable. And as our brains get acclimated this way, what it does is it tends to reduce our range of capability. In other words, once we adjust to air conditioning, pretty soon we need air conditioning, and pretty soon we cannot tolerate the absence of air conditioning. So, in that sense, comfort addiction is an apt description of this process that in our society we all undergo. We come to the place of brain dependence on this comfort or that. And when we do, soon we lose our stomach for difficult things. We become less able to navigate life as life really is, because life is difficult. And life comes with pain, and life comes with challenges, and life comes with hardship. We become less able to navigate life as life is. What an addiction to comfort does in our brains is it tends to lower our immunity to tough times. We adjust to comfort. And when we do, we become less likely to take James up on his offer. We become less likely to see pain and suffering as a gift. We become less likely to see our trials and our troubles as a doorway into a grand opportunity. And when we become less tolerant of external discomfort, we also tend to become less tolerant of internal discomfort. We become less tolerant of our anxiety. We become less capable of handling our anger, less tolerant of fear, less tolerant of uncertainty, less tolerant of guilt. We begin to frame these experiences as bad because they are surely uncomfortable. And we begin to equate in our minds a symmetry between discomfort and bad. So, when we begin to see uncomfortable interior states as not normal, we don't see them as invitations to explore our false self constructs. So in that sense, comfort can be a problem the way that antibacterial soap can become a problem. If we kill off too many bacteria, we are not as immune to those bacteria when we encounter them. Our immune systems get weakened. Our immunity to difficulties becomes weakened. And life is painful. We've done as a society a great job of keeping our discomfort at bay, but that cannot be sustained. Even though pain can be a gift, when we get overly attached to ease, when we get overly attached to comfort, difficulties overwhelm us, and we leave the gift of our tradition unclaimed. Now, most of us fear rejection, and most of us fear failure. But if we weigh the pain of rejection and the pain of failure too heavily, then we won't go out and meet people. We won't push past the obstacles to intimacy, and there are obstacles to intimacy. If we weigh the pain of those fears that we have too heavily, we won't take risks that could open doors and possibilities for our future. We certainly will not restitch the torn fabric of community. We won't take James up on his offer, and we won't become resilient. Now, that notion that I just described, in general, is a notion that our society resists. Most of us pick up the idea from the culture around us that if we feel too sad, or if we feel too anxious, or if we are too angry, it is likely an illness. It has likely become a disorder. It is most likely not normal, and it is certainly not an opportunity. Comfort dependence tends to limit our resilience. But struggle and difficulty are pathways into health. Hard times and painful times do open us to a journey beyond the false self. But if we lose our stomach for struggle, if we lose our stomach for pain, community making won't happen. Community making is difficult. Working the circle won't happen. Working the circle is uncomfortable. The things that our tradition tells us are so transformative in our lives are costly, all of them. They're demanding, all of them. They're uncomfortable, and they're difficult. They're often painful. I was listening to a book while I was driving in the car, and I was speaking notes into my phone. On the basis of things that I heard on that book, but in the process of that and being trying careful to make sure that I am keeping my eyes on the road and all those things, what I didn't do is write down the name of the book or the author. So I've got these notes, and I have no idea where they came from. I'd love to give someone credit, but they came from someplace. Not using the word comfort dependence, the book said this: comfort dependence correlates with a rise in anxiety, a decline in resilience. Works like this. We fear that the world is going to come and take away some comfort to which we have grown accustomed. And the thing is, we're right. The world will always and inevitably take away our comforts. then we fear. We fear that we won't be able to handle the pain that will accompany the loss of that comfort. So when it happens, we are afraid our response will be unable to handle the pain. That's what comfort dependence does. It rises anxiety. Further, comfort dependence tends to make us more self-focused, less altruistic, less able to think about the larger good, because working toward the larger good is often uncomfortable, is often demanding, it is often difficult. We must lay down some personal comfort in order to pursue what is good for the larger whole. Also, comfort dependence tends to weaken self-control. In other words, when we have grown accustomed to fast lanes so we don't have to wait in traffic, when traffic comes, the waiting becomes intolerable. Well, if waiting in traffic is intolerable, how are we going to be patient with our life partners when they are working through their blind spots and it is taking much longer than it should? And how will we wait for the right time to make a purchase? How will we wait for a healthy timetable for our sexuality to unfold on? Also, researchers found that comfort dependence tends to heighten our disgust response, what we can't tolerate because it's disgusting. A series of interviews conducted with middle schoolers found that those who had a higher dependence on comfort had a higher disgust response to nature. For them, nature was more dirty than it was for the lower comfort addiction candidates. Dirt and rocks and leaves were germy or unclean, unsanitary, or foul. And the prospect of being in nature also evoked a disgust response. It was unimaginable to them not to have access to showers or flush toilets or hot water or air conditioning or mattresses. Now again, mattresses are a wonderful thing. Air conditioning is a wonderful thing. Comfort is not the problem. It is an inappropriate dependence upon comfort that becomes the problem. As long as we do not have to have comfort, comfort can be wonderful. But once we have to have it, it becomes a really big problem. An addiction to comfort undercuts the wisdom of James. We can't allow our troubles to be a gift. The prospect of pain is just too overwhelming. We don't let our pain do what pain does, and consequently, we miss the point of pain. We spend all of our time trying to get out of pain as opposed to trying to get out of pain what we need to get out of pain. Our cultural acclimation to comfort dependence, the water we swim in, the air that we breathe, this acclimation to which we have all fallen prey often leaves us without the instinct or the inclination to pursue the greater good, to unearth the thing under the thing, to discern our false self strategies and step back from them. Our ancient wisdom is uncomfortable. Our ancient wisdom is difficult. It is demanding. But it also affords us a truth informed by the world as the world really is. This world is demanding, it is difficult, and it is painful. And thus informed, our tradition offers us a truth that works. Now, as we've seen in so many instances, our tradition intuited this a long time ago and left for us a legacy of tools to help us navigate this problem. So we've been taught a set of things to do that, if we do them, will prepare us for this dynamic. We are taught to fast in our tradition. We are taught to intentionally set aside times without food, to intentionally impose upon ourselves the discomfort of hunger, and to relinquish the curse of comfort so that we can enjoy the gift of comfort. Food is not, as our tradition has fallen prey to, food is not a problem. The pleasure of food is not a problem. The comfort that comes with food is not a problem. What is a problem is when we become so dependent upon things that we need them that we don't need. And so we start with something small and manageable, like two meals in a week, and we go without them. And in that process of imposing a small, manageable amount of discomfort on ourselves, we begin to train ourselves not to be dependent upon comfort. We are taught to fast. During Lent, we are encouraged by our tradition to go without X, or to add to our lives the practice of Y. And among the many reasons that we do that, there is also this one: to free ourselves from an excessive dependence upon those things that bring about ease in our lives, comfort in our lives. Dependence is the problem. We are taught in our tradition to practice voluntary simplicity. In other words, not to consume everything that we earn, but to live on what we need and use the balance for something more meaningful than just piling on comfort after comfort after comfort after comfort. We are taught to practice generosity, to give of ourselves and to give of our time and to give of our resources to others, because the world needs what we have to give, but also because we need to challenge this dynamic, this drive inside of ourselves to think only of ourselves and to challenge our fear of discomfort, to challenge our dependence upon it. We do these things not because of some maudlin idea that we should be masochists and we shouldn't enjoy the good things. That's not why we do it. We undertake these ancient practices so that we may see. Because when we see, we create the possibility of being free. Our society, having normalized comfort dependence, sends us the message that these ancient disciplines, like fasting and voluntary simplicity and all of these things, sends us the message that these disciplines, what they're called is the disciplines of engagement and the disciplines of engagement. That's what the tradition calls them. Our society sends us the message that they are maudlin, that they are masochistic. They are not. They are how we participate with the ancient wisdom. We don't wait for life to drop pain into our lives. We invite the process intentionally, purposely, before it happens. We undertake these arduous practices to free ourselves from truths that are not true, to eschew the idea that the best life is the comfortable life, because that is not true. I heard this notion when I was 16. Took me a little while to warm up to the idea, but by the time I was 19, I fasted once a week, every Wednesday, from dinner till dinner. I would eat dinner, and then I would eat dinner again. And I did that for 20 years. And I can testify to the truth of the ancient wisdom, that there is freedom for our souls when we are free from our dependence on comfort. I stopped at the end of 20 years because I'd come to see that my approach to that was also laden with some unhealthy perspective, and so I stepped back from those disciplines of disengagement, and after about 5 or 10 years of that, I began to realize, yeah, I'm back into the cycle of overly depending upon comfort, and I had to come back and restore some different practices into my life. But the ancient wisdom tells us that the good life is not the comfortable life. The good life is the free from false self life. That's the highest life. The life of awareness that looks for and finds the thing under the thing. The life that can chart a new way that is not dependent, not trapped in, not mindlessly slaving away under the false constructs that we carry around, that we call self. That's the highest life. That's the good life. That's the resilient life. And I do pray that it is becoming your life and that it's becoming my life. May it be so within us. Amen.